The following is a teaching by Dr. Ken Boa from the Leadership Series on the subject of structure and organization.
We're going to be taking a look, and I'm going to have you turn to Exodus 18 as we take a look at what the Bible says about another leadership principle. And this leadership principle is structure or organization, and what the scriptures teach us about this particular skill and the need for structure and organization, both in our private lives and in our public lives as well, our inner world and our outer world. Years ago, you might recall a book came out by Gordon MacDonald called Ordering Your Private World. If you haven't read that, I'd strongly encourage you to take a look at that book, Ordering Your Private World. It's a very rich and helpful resource to kind of guide us through the process of realizing that a lot of us can have outward worlds that are very clear and tight, but the inward world can be in chaos. In any case, organizations are very good things, as we well know, because they gather multiple resources. And ultimately, it can accomplish a good deal more than any individual can accomplish. And the scriptures are going to be, once again, a paradigm and a model for what organization looks like, because organization comes from the hand of God Himself. And what we have here in our text to introduce the concept of organization, we selected this passage as being the best illustration of that. Again, when we were mapping out each of these themes, we had to discern what's the best one that I would use to illustrate how organization works. And we came up with Jethro and Moses. Now, you might not have thought of that passage, but it's a good text because here Moses is being worn out by his daily responsibilities in trying to adjudicate various legal issues among the people of Israel. And he's just being worn out. His father-in-law visits him. And Jethro is pleased to see, in fact, comes to understand that Moses really is serving the one true God as a result of the Exodus and what the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And if you look at Exodus 18, and specifically verse 9, it says, Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing him from the hand of the Egyptians, for he said, "Praise be to the Lord who rescued you." And he says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than the other gods." So he understands this. Now what takes place later on, though, in verse 14, is when his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, because what happened was Moses would take his seat as judge for the people. And they stood around him from morning till evening. And when his father-in-law saw this, he asked this question, "What is this that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Not bad. Not a bad question to raise. Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws." Now notice what his father-in-law said. He said, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone." And then he gives them instructions. He says, "Listen now, I'm going to give you some advice. May God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to Him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties they are to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this and God so commands, you'll be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." And so he listened to him and did all that his father had said. This, I think Jethro is history's first recorded management consultant. Because that's exactly what he's doing. He's saying you're going to wear yourself out. Note the criteria he told them to use, though, in selecting these men. He said to teach them. First of all, he said, "I want you to take a group of people and to teach them and equip them and train them so that they are knowledgeable in these truths, in the ways of God, how to live, the duties they're to perform." But then he also said, notice, here's the criteria. Men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain. And so you need to choose carefully the men that you're going to have delegated authority. The point here is that Moses handpicked potential leaders, he trained them, and then he empowered them. And this is what we see in this text. I want you to also notice that though Moses was in a position of strength and leadership, it's important to note that he was willing to get the idea from his father-in-law. That is to say, he was open and willing to allow others to tweak the structure of the organization. He was willing then to strengthen the organization by allowing others to be involved. There was a measure of humility in Moses, and he was receptive to wise counsel. So it's important for us to grasp this text. It's a very important concept. We're going to come back to it. But if you'll consider how the cosmos as a whole, when we look at God, and we always go then to when we talk about a theme, for example, structure and organization, we always look at that in terms of who God is, then who we are, then how we think, and then what we do. Now, what text would you choose to speak about God in terms of structure and organization? What might you? There'd be a lot of good ones you could use. What text would illustrate God as one who organizes things and who has structure and hierarchy and symmetry and beauty? There are a variety you might choose. Anyone come to your mind? Genesis 1 and 2 would be great examples, wouldn't they? Because there, God takes this chaos and shapes it into order. Because he creates the original raw material, and it says, without form and void. That is to say, it was formless, and then it was also devoid of life. It was void. And then the first period of time, he begins to shape, and the various days correspond to how he then shaped and then filled, shaped and populated. And so we see at the end that we have a universe, not a multiverse. That the world that we consider in this world is a universe. That's a good word, isn't it? It's unified together. It's not chaotic. The very fact that we can be here and talk about it, the very fact that it has laws and principles by which it's governed is remarkable. When you think of the fact that the universe is replete with intelligent design, take any simple living system, let alone the human brain, which is the most complex thing in all of the created order. Imagine the order and beauty and elegance and design, more complex and sophisticated and subtle than the most sophisticated computer yet devised or one that could ever be devised. But the text we decided to use instead of Genesis was Revelation. And we decided to go to Revelation chapter 4 to illustrate structure and organization. And the reason why we did that is because this marvelous text portrays God's heavenly throne and the exquisite, amazing beauty that surrounds it. There's a vision that John has in heaven of the heavenly throne that symbolically describes what is actually beyond human comprehension. And this passage gives us a glimpse of symmetry and hierarchical order that surrounds the manifest presence of the eternal God. Listen, for example, to verse 2 of Revelation 4. Once I was in the Spirit, because actually God invited him in verse 1, he heard a voice saying, come up here and I'll show you what must take place after this. And so at once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it, and the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. He has to use the image of stones to kind of portray the fact that everything is suffused with light and radiance, and it's almost like living stones, and it's exquisite in its beauty. The one who sat there then is surrounded by a rainbow resembling an emerald. We have a rainbow encircling the throne. You might, by the way, parenthetically realize that nobody knew that rainbows were circular until we were able to fly. In other words, when you go above the clouds, then you see rainbows are circular. Have you ever looked down on a rainbow from an airplane? They're circular. But in any case, here we have a circular rainbow surrounding the throne of God, of emerald in color. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones. And seated on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings and peals of thunder. There's a sense of awe and power and wonder here. Before the throne, seven lamps were blazing. These are the seven spirits of God. Also before the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. In the center, around the throne, were four living creatures, and they were covered with eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second like an ox, the third had a face like a man, the fourth was like a flying eagle. It's also reminiscent of the cherubim in Ezekiel chapter 1. Each of the four living creatures had six wings and was covered with eyes all around, even under his wings. Day and night they never stopped saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And then it says, whenever the living creatures gave glory, honor, and thanks to him who sits in the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who sits in the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. And they lay their crowns before the throne. And they say, "You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory, honor, and power. For you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being." Later in Revelation 5, it describes the one who is the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Lion who is the Lamb, and describes the fact that he is worthy to take the scroll and open it in verse 9. But you'll notice then in verse 11, "I looked and heard the voice of many angels," because these angels aren't specifically mentioned in Revelation 4, but they're part of the scene as well, "numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. Now that's a billion. So you have a lot of angels, billions of angels. "And they encircle the throne and the living creatures and the elders." So you have this almost spherical imagery here of different concentric spheres, various hierarchies, thrones and dominions and rulers and authorities, all surrounding in this like nimbus of light and glory and beauty, dazzling in its appearance, awesome in the sound. We see a picture here, a portrait of everything focusing around the throne of the living God. It's an awesome picture to contemplate. Talk about order and organization. We're not talking about chaos here. We're talking about absolute glory, symmetry, design, perfect order, form, dignity, power, harmonious structure, a society that is exquisite and perfect. That is the image here of the God we serve, because the God we serve is a God who loves order and beauty, and he wants us to have a harmonious society as well. And the only way you have harmony, by the way, among people, as we well know, is by having right relationships that are other-centered and empowered by the love of the living God. And that's, of course, God's vision for heaven. Because when we are there, then sin will have been removed, and then all dysfunctionality and selfishness and disorder and chaos will have been removed, and all will be brought into this harmonious and beautiful peace. God has a penchant, then, for structure and beauty and harmony that can be seen in any living creature. And if we take that in mind, we want to think of Christ as the one who called it into being, because he's the one through whom all things were made. And so it says in Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, "By him," speaking of Christ, "all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together." Which means that he holds all the cosmos together. And if he were to let loose of that grip, all things would fall apart. Now one can speculate. For example, I've talked to you about this before, though you might not remember this, that one of the four fundamental forces in nature is what we call, out of our ignorance, the strong force. Great term. We have no idea what it is, but it's the force that binds the nuclei of atoms together. Because nuclei consist of protons and neutrons. Now, neutrons are neutral, but protons, what's their charge? You'll remember this. Protons are positive. Now, what happens when you squeeze particles that have the same charge together, and the closer they get, what happens? You remember it with magnets. Remember you took the two north poles, and as you moved them together, what would happen? You remember this. I'm bringing you back to sixth grade science. They repel, and in fact, the repelling force increases. It's inversely proportional to the square of the distance. And so the closer they get, the greater that force. Now think of how close these little items are, these protons. So exquisitely packed together are they. And we have no clue as to what holds them together, except we call it the strong force. So exquisite is that force that if you could capture that force, the strong force, in a teaspoonful of water, the equivalent of that force in a teaspoonful of water, it would have enough energy to drive the Queen Mary II back and across to Liverpool and back to the United States. Just that little bit of strong force. And if he were to remove the strong force for even a split second, all matter would instantaneously turn into energy. Instantaneously, the whole thing would disappear. He holds all things together and ties things together by the word of his power. This world is held together and sustained by the living God. Having said that, we see this image of thrones and powers and rulers and authorities. There's this angelic hierarchy that's going on here. So we have these various realms and regions and kinds of angels and forces that are involved, so that we have this beauty of God who creates this universe, not a multiverse, and who shapes and turns our chaos into his order. And the chaos of a human life can be transmuted into the order of God's beauty if we will allow him to rule and to reign in our lives, to bring it under his tutelage and domination. Let us go on to another image of structure and organization. Now, specifically, having looked at God briefly, what about ourselves? We are a people who have been created in his image. And because we've been created in his image, we're called upon to shape this world and shape our inner worlds and our outer worlds through discipline and skill. If you turn to 1 Corinthians 14, there's a little verse that summarizes this, speaking about the worship of the early church in the first century churches, where he says everything should be done in a fitting and orderly way, decently and in order. It goes on to say in earlier, 1 Corinthians 14:33, that God is not a God of disorder, but of peace, of shalom, of harmony. And so the imagery of peace is an imagery of harmony, of the pieces fitting perfectly together. And the image here of the worship of the local church should reflect that, that even in the early house churches in the first century, as you know, they weren't building church buildings. In fact, there are almost no church buildings that were built before the Edict of Milan by Constantine in 313, because churches were regarded as being actually illegal. In the Roman Empire, as you know, Christianity was declared to be an illicit religion. They called it a religio illicita. And after, as you well know, there were periods of persecution under Emperor Diocletian and Decius and other emperors. There were about 10 periods of when waves of persecution. And so the people of God would meet specifically in homes. They did that from the get-go in the first century. And typically, that was the case. They would meet privately or in homes, not unlike what we see in the underground churches in some parts of the world. For example, China, where there'd have to be that kind of a hiddenness. I might parenthetically mention, whenever the church is persecuted that way, it usually has vitality. When the church is now actually part of society, it loses its power. Hence the institutional church, the national state church of Europe, how that completely died and lost its real power and vitality. But the point is that even in those house churches, they had a pattern for worship that encouraged the body of believers to use their individual spiritual gifts to the greatest mutual benefit and effect, so that they would actually have a structure of leadership and guidelines so that power and authority and edification would flow through the organizational structure, so it would be seen to be the organization would be a tool to service the organism. The problem is, typically, we always go back to the visible and forget the invisible. And we go for the organization more than the organism. The church is a body of Christ, is an organism of people, and we can reduce it, though, to an organization if we're not careful. But the organizational structure is designed to serve the organism, but then we get the tail wagging the dog. And what happens after a while is then the people are called to serve the structure. You know how that works. And this happens all the time. But the point here is that there are needs for order, and God's instituted authority structures. He's instituted it in the spheres of marriage, in the sphere of parenting, in the sphere of the church, and in the sphere of the state. So God uses authority structures, and in spite of the fact that those authorities are imperfect because of sin, still they're needful to overcome what otherwise would take place, the chaos and the disorder that would take place if they were not there. Another text that I want us to consider as we look at, okay, how do we think about this, would be in Numbers chapter 11. And there in Numbers 11, we have another picture of structure and organization. This is the passage where Moses is doing a little complaining here. He becomes exceedingly angry because he hears the people wailing because they're all complaining and whining. You know, they were great at murmuring and grumbling and griping and complaining, the people. And Moses was getting fed up with this. In fact, he had a very honest relationship with God. In Numbers 11, verse 11, he said, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you've put the burden of all these people on me?" Very honest prayer here, you know. And he goes on to say, "Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant into the land you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, 'Give us meat to eat.' I can't carry all these people by myself. The burden's too heavy for me." So he's kind of getting mad. But he's very, very honest with God. "If this is how you're going to treat me," he says, "put me to death right now. If I found favor in your eyes, and let me not face my own ruin." Now, God in effect says, lighten up, calm down. There's a solution to this. He says, "Bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials," verse 16, "among the people. Have them come to the tent of meeting, and that they may stand there with you. I will come down and speak to you there, and I will take of the spirit that's on you and put my spirit on them. They will help you carry the burden of the people so that you will not have to carry it all alone." Another image, isn't it, of the idea of distribution and delegation, taking part of the spirit that's on Moses and now actually putting it on these 70 elders who were people who had proven track records of authority and leadership, so that he looks at people that he can then nurture and nourish and build into so that they can carry. These are qualified persons, and they're empowered now to help share the burden. I might mention, by the way, when we look at these structures, especially when we go to the New Testament and look at the structure for the church's organization, when Paul wrote to churches or pastors, he never spelled out in detail how the church would be structured. That there would be structure in the sense of elders and deacons and so forth, but that the interesting thing, it was so loose in the sense of the details that it was able to be adapted to different cultures and societies in the last 2,000 years. This was genius because it means that the church then can adapt perfectly. If it's in Nigeria, if it's in China, if it's in India, the church can be adapted according to the need of the culture. And it's not too rigid. Yet there is still a genuine form of structure, but it's flexible, one that can adjust. So that we do not want to use the same structure when you have 20 people as when you have 2,000 people. And it's necessary for us to see that, frankly, structure exists to enable resources of power and information to flow through an organization. That structure is not sacred. It's not cast in concrete. It doesn't work any more than what you do is you change it. This is true in our lives, that we as leaders are called to love and serve our followers. In turn, followers are called to love one another and follow their leaders. That's a picture. You are known by your biblical leadership actually will characterize you when you love and serve those people who follow you. It's a servant leadership that's the model in Scripture. And that servant leadership extends to the home, to parenting, to your relationships with people in your arena of influence, as well as to the work environment. That we are called to be people who serve others. The question isn't who's boss as much as it is who's going to serve these people so that they can get on with their lives. So the issue is always this issue of serving and empowering people to be fulfilled. That's a biblical portrait of what the structure is designed to do, to allow it to flow into the lives of people and thus nurture them. And notice as well, in both cases, with Jethro and also here, Moses was given a final authority. So though he delegated it, he still, though, had a measure of authority so that there would be certain things that he himself alone could do. But the point is that they were empowered and they were chosen, really, by that authority rather than by the people. It was not a democracy. And I may say, this is a very important idea. You must be empowered by God to be an effective servant. You will not be an effective servant unless you really are empowered by the other-centered authority and grace of God Himself. Otherwise, you and I in our flesh will tend to manipulate people rather than to serve them. And to minister to people and to serve them is to be empowered by God. And it is a biblical picture here that you have authority, and yet you also seek to use that authority in a way that nurtures and nourishes and empowers other people and equips them and sustains them and builds into them. And that's why I would also mention as leaders, it's your mission as well to be involved in mentoring relationships. And I've talked about this before, that you as a leader need to and have some structure whereby you have peer mentors, that is to say people who encourage you and you encourage on a peer level, but also for there to be vertical mentors. Now, a vertical mentor can be upwards, someone who's further down the road than you are, and you will need to be the one who pursues such a person, or the vertical can be where you're the up vertical mentor and you're reaching to people who now need to be nurtured and built up in your life. And so that can be a both way. But mentoring is to also build into people. And I believe that God's placed people in your spheres of authority already for that purpose. Many in your organizations, for example. So there's kind of like a little shift that you need to make, a kind of perspective shift, a paradigm shift where you see yourself not just running a company, but really empowering people and building into their lives. Taking a look then at the last text I want us to consider, that would be in Deuteronomy 1. At the end of his life, Moses is about to pass on the baton of leadership to Joshua. By the way, that's an interesting subject by itself, succession. And the idea of equipping and preparing for your successor is an interesting notion. And Moses carefully prepares for his successor and with humility wants to build into them. A level 5 leader that, according to Jim Collins, is a person who is not so proud. He wants to actually, he focuses on the best of the company. A level 4 leader, on the other hand, is often a person whose ego demands are so great that he actually will, when he leaves, almost make sure that the company folds or doesn't do as well. It's an interesting difference that one person's not so consumed with himself that he wants to be the star. But Moses was in what I would call a level 5 leader insofar as he had a combination of personal humility, but at the same time, an intense drive and focus to really build into the people. But he subsumed his ego, personal ego needs, into the needs of the others. In Deuteronomy 1, then, he's summarizing as they're in the land of Moab and they're about to cross the Jordan River. You recall Moses himself will not be allowed to go over there. Joshua will have to lead him across because Moses, you recall, disobeyed God by striking the rock the second time. The first time he was supposed to strike it. Later on, in his anger, which was his fundamental flaw. By the way, every one of us has a fundamental flaw. You do understand this, don't you? It'd be a good idea to figure out what your fundamental flaw is. Moses was anger. And in his anger, because of the people murmuring and griping, he struck the rock when God told him to speak to the rock the second time. Because you see, the rock is Christ, as the New Testament describes it. And thus, it destroys the symbolism, because the symbolism was that he would be struck but once. One time sacrifice, and it actually distorts the spiritual symbolism, but that's another story. The point is, he disobeyed God, and God took it quite seriously. You might say that was a kind of a minor offense not to let the guy go over there, but with too much has been given, you tell me. What's the rest of it? Much is required. And so he was not allowed to go and see it, though he was given, by the way, a supernatural vision of the whole land. But in preparing the people, he talks about appointing leaders and reviews the story with him and Jethro. So in chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, he reviews that story in verse 12. How can I bear your problems and your burdens and your disputes all by myself? Choose wise, understanding, and respected men from each of your tribes, and I will set them over you. You answered me, what you purpose to do is good. So I took the leading men of your tribes, wise and respected men, and appointed them to have authority over you and so forth. And so, but I want you to notice something extra that's here. Look at verse 17. These people were told, do not show partiality in judging. Speaking about those judges again. Hear, both small and great alike, do not be afraid of any man, for judgment belongs to God. Boy, that is an insight for the kind of people you want to have authority. That is to say, people who are not so impressed with people, but they're more concerned with pleasing the living God, that they will not show partiality, that they will not be impressed, they will not be manipulated by power, but they will serve to adjudicate properly, to hear both the small and the great, because everybody has equal dignity in the sight of God. It's our structure and our society that tells us otherwise, because we are taught from the get-go that a man who has power and possessions and prestige and popularity should be treated with greater dignity and respect than a person who does not have those accoutrements. Yet God says that is completely wrong. Such a power has no more value in the eyes of God than those who are small. And so it is an issue here of the kind of people he pursued. I might mention, by the way, that these structures are relative, not absolute. We've talked about that. We seize upon different ways, and if it doesn't work, you modify it. Structures are dynamic and flexible, and they are local, not hierarchical. That is to say that you want to have structures that maximize the power of local participants and to embrace the fullest human potential, that you want to see that they are missional, not institutional. A structure is not designed to just infuse the institution with power, but to be infusing its mission with power. So the structure is not an end in itself. It's designed to help you to fulfill the mission that you have embraced, both personally and corporately. I'll be perfectly frank with you. It's a deep mystery that God bothers with working with us at all. It'd be a good deal easier for him to do it himself. To be perfectly frank with you, it'd be a lot cleaner and a lot less messy. There's the mystery that he is wise and powerful enough that at the end, when it's all through, we'll look back and see it'll mean greater glory that he was able to use these people who are such schleps. He'll be able to use them to accomplish. It'll be a greater thing than if he'd just done it himself. I'll close.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.